For the best liberty-oriented talk 24/7, visit LRN.fm.
And so it is, the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.
In your heart, you know he's right.
I hear there's rumors on the internets.
This is Liberty in Exile with your host, Yael Osofsky.
Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bring you liberty, not to destroy it. The evil the governments do lives after them. The good is often turned to their bones. So let it be with liberty and exile. Let us begin. Hello and welcome to the program. I am your host, Yael Osofsky, broadcasting from the Philly Freedom Studio on the Liberty Radio Network and on the No Agenda Stream on this, the third day of October 2011. Our website, as always, is libertyinexile.com. That is libertyinexile.com. There you'll find all the articles, the links, the videos, and more. Very important in this day and age of media deception. And isn't that exactly what we're living through, ladies and gentlemen? That's what is seen on our television screens and in our newspapers day in and day out. It's a constant theme, it seems, on this show, but it seems to propel the world forth on the spinning doldrums of the lies of those in power. Now, I speak, of course, of the latest ramification of a tyrannical presidential policy. I'm speaking about the assassination of an American citizen by using the flying robot killing machines we call drones. Now, if you've been paying attention to the news in the last week, you've seen this bearded face come upon your screen. This is a man whose name is Anwar al-Awlaki. Here is a man who has joined the ranks of the Al-Qaeders. A man who has started his own YouTube channels, who has been an imam in the past, and who has inspired generations of Al-Qaeders, as the media would have you assume. Now, whatever his position may be, whatever his content is on his YouTube channel, it goes without saying that he is guaranteed certain rights. Now, I, as a newly naturalized American citizen, am very familiar with these rights. They're written out in the Constitution, in the Fifth Amendment. This has to do with due process. It has to do with an American citizen who, upon being charged with a crime, is brought before a jury and a judge, and his crimes are stood and demeanored. Now, for those who have been following that, there have been the voices who have come from the left, voices who have come from the right, who have condemned or have praised the president on his action. And might I say that the chorus does favor the president and the power structure, as it always does. So let us get a little taste of what it's like when a journalist goes and actually tries to question the official line. This is presidential spokeshole at the White House, Jay Carney, speaking with Jake Tapper, reporter for ABC. And you'll see how Jay Carney is left with trying to craft his words around it. There is no excuse, and you shall see. Let us roll the clip.
You are asserting that he had operational control of the cargo plot and the Abdul-Muttalib plot. Mm-hmm. He's now dead. Mm-hmm. Can you show us, or the American people, or has a judge been shown?
Jake, I'm not going to go any further than what I've said about the circumstances of his death and the case against them, which, again, you're linking. And I think that
No, you said that he was responsible for these things.
Yes, but again,
is there going to be any evidence presented?
You know, I don't have anything for you on that.
Do you not see at all? Does the administration not see at all how a president asserting that he has the right to kill an American citizen without due process, and that he's not going to even explain why he thinks he has that right, is troublesome to some people?
I wasn't aware of any of those things that you said actually happening, and again, I'm not going to address the circumstances of Alaki's death. I think it's, again, it is an important fact that this terrorist who is actively plotting, had plotted in the past and is actively plotting to attack Americans and American interests, is dead. But I'm not going to, from any angle, discuss the circumstances of his death.
You know that the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU tried to get permission to represent Alaki. His father had asked them to do that. But they needed to get permission from the Treasury Department and so that they could challenge his being on this targeted killing list. And the administration, the Obama administration, refused to let them represent him. To not even, he couldn't even have the ACLU representing him.
I would send those questions or take those questions to Treasury or Justice. I don't have anything on that for you.
What do you think constitutional law professor Barack Obama would make of this?
I think he spoke about it today.
Oh, that's my favorite part there. What would constitutional law professor Barack Obama have to say about that? And that's what I find so interesting about this presidency that we're living through in our times, is that our current president was supposed to be a scholar of the Constitution. We've seen again and again, whether it be the invasion of Libya, the assassination of an American citizen, the bailing out of the banks, the continual and perpetual war, overriding Congress on small issues and large issues alike, we've seen that this has not been the greatest example of how a constitution should be treated. And what was once a republic has retreated into something that someone like Cornel West would call a plutocracy. But that is aside the point. We'll get more to that in a second when we talk about soaking the rich. Let's talk a little bit more about this. Now, it's very important to look at the different voices that come out in speaking about al-Alaqui, because the general public, in being faced with a situation like this, does not know much what to do. They sort of look to the people on television to create the reaction for them. Usually, most of the time, people would not know who Anwar al-Alaqui is. They don't pay attention. People are busy on the job, they're watching sports, they're doing those things. So when they see a small clip and they need some sort of explanation, the power structure likes to invite people who, you know, will defend the positions of the president and defend the positions of the government. Case in point, Michael Hayden, who was brought on CNN's State of the Union with Candy Crowley in order to explain the use of drones in this situation, the use of drones in Pakistan and all of our wars abroad. Now, one thing that is interesting about this is that he is part of the Chertoff Consulting Group, which, as we so know, is the group which profits immensely from those body scanner in the airports, and it is run by former Secretary of Homeland Security Michael Chertoff, who, as we know, once again, was trying to push these machines back in the debate over the TSA and airline security. And as soon as all of these so-called terrorist attempts happen, Anwar al-Muttalib, Christmas Day bomber and the like, they were pushing those scanners on us. So let's listen to this clip of Hayden, who is now a scholar at the Chertoff Group, a leading consultant, and it is now a sort of consultant himself for CNN. So let us play a little clip. But I need to preface it with something, in that we look at Michael Hayden's background, we find out that he was actually, oh, that's right, director of the CIA until 2009. That is what this nation has stumped to, ladies and gentlemen. Let's hear what the official government line is.
Because the president has almost quadrupled the number of drone attacks, especially into Pakistan, that the Bush administration launched and been quite successful. They have wiped out, in not just with drone attacks, but in other ways, a lot of top terrorists. Do you worry that these drone attacks, because they take out innocent people, they didn't happen to, as far as we know, in this last attack, but they take out innocent people often, they miss their targets, and they upset the local population. Pakistan comes to mind. Does that worry you?
Well, first of all, I challenge a bit the premise of the question about collateral damage and killing innocents. That's much overblown without getting into any operational details that we obviously can't confirm
Doesn't
or deny.
Happen?
Never say never. But I do think there are some audiences out there who greatly exaggerate what we call collateral damage.
Collateral
this
damage.
This has proven to be a wonderful weapon in this war. Two successive presidents have used it. It has probably been the single most impactful thing we have done to cripple al-Qaeda. We've crippled al-Qaeda main to a point now that most people think they're almost not capable of attacking the American homeland. And now we've shifted over here to Yemen. And if I could just add to a thought to what the congresswoman said, think about al-Awlaki in terms of the near and the far enemy. He was the part of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula that motivated them and enabled them to go after the far enemy. That's us. And so in that sense, his death makes America much more safe. Frankly, though, Candy, it has less of a direct impact on the fate or health of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. In fact, with his being gone, they may be even more focused against the near enemy, and that's Yemen and Saudi Arabia.
Now, first off, to begin with, let us I had two things that came to mind in listening to that. First off, he kept saying Yemen. Now, the name of the country is Yemen, and when you say yay, ma'am, that makes it seem as if that's when they were sitting in the back room, and they're saying, well, boss, we got these new drones that have come in that basically can go in and just kill people from the sky, and they won't even hear it. Well, yay, man, where are we going to put them? That's exactly what happened. And second thing that I had from that is that he said al-Qaeda main. That's something that he said in there. Al-Qaeda main. They're always talking about these franchises of al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Al-Qaeda here and there and everywhere. And they always use these terms, these monikers. As I saw one report on CNN calling Anwar al-Awlaki the chief of external operations. I mean, I hope that these guys haven't been offshoring their jobs. I think that's the only question that I have. I really hope they haven't been doing that. Keep that domestic economy afloat. Whenever they're having their board meetings about what's going on, I just hope that the shareholders are getting their fair share. Now, this is very troublesome. It's troublesome because you have the former leader of the CIA going on national television and trying to brainwash the people into accepting that this is an okay thing, that flying killing robot machines that we've invented are the, as he said, single greatest tool that we've used in fighting al-Qaeda. Now, first off, I don't believe that many of these instances where there are certain terror attacks or threats of terror, anything like Christmas Day bombing, but let's use one of their examples. This was in Times Square in May of 2010. You had Faril Shahzad. He was the man who tried to light a bunch of fertilizer on fire in a car, and he was smoking and all. And they brought him into court, and they asked him why he did it. And he did a long speech, and he said, I mean, we remember this from the reports, that he was doing it as retaliation because the United States was using drones to kill people in Pakistan, and they had killed members of his own family. These things do nothing but create blowback and are nothing but targeted assassination campaigns, which, if we were once a republic, we would have won at one time, consider them grossly illegal, grossly unconstitutional, grossly immoral. But we no longer live in that age. That is not our age now, ladies and gentlemen. That is not how it works. But there are some people that we can look to once again, and it always happens to be the same man. It always happens to be the same message. Can you believe that some politicians are actually consistent in what they believe and what they preach to followers? Here's a clip of Representative Ron Paul, who's running for president, talking about this assassination. This is when it was a theoretical assassination back in January of 2010. Let's listen to what he said then versus what he is saying today. Roll the clip.
The post 9/11 atmosphere that really worries me. It worries me about how much our CIA is involved overseas. And this week, I could not believe a headline that said the president was considering the legality of assassinating an American citizen. Now, that's true. It's true. He was born in this country, and he's a Muslim, and he's identified to be with people who don't like us. So they want to declare him an enemy combatant, which they can do by, like, the Attorney General, the President. Oh, he's an enemy combatant, and therefore he has no rights. Now you say, well, yeah, but he's a terrorist. Well, no, he is maybe a suspect, and nothing has been proven. He might be a bad guy, but is that the way you take care of bad guys? Talking in the White House about assassinating this guy? I mean, what happens if conditions get really bad and we start talking to each other about some of the terrible things that Washington, D.C. is going to us? Are we going to be enemy combatants? Because the precedent has been set already for American citizens to be in prison indefinitely. This is why we should protect the civil liberties of all suspects, and we shouldn't be putting people in prison in secret rendition and without a trial, without due process, without an attorney, and then on top of that, add on torture. That, to me, is not what America is all about. So these fears that I have and that you may have is connected to the economic system, because if the economic system breaks down, then there's going to be more challenges. People, after most Americans endorse the idea that after 9/11, oh, we're under attack. What do you want us to do? And just so many times I would hear, even if going through the lines at the airport, well, if this is what it takes, you know, we have to give up some of our freedoms to be free. And, you know, it was said a while ago, which I strongly endorse, that you don't have to give up your liberties to be free. Matter of fact, if you give them up, you can't be free. And yet a lot of people believe that. And if we have turmoil in this country, the same thing is going to happen. Yes, there will be a lot of poverty and a lot of problems and law and order breakdown. And they say, well, do whatever you can to make us safe and secure. Governments can't make you safe and secure. Do you think you're safe in your house because there's a policeman guarding your house? You're probably more safe in your house because of the Second Amendment than you are because of a policeman.
Now, I let that go on a little long because I think it's very interesting how he draws it and how he sort of ties in the entire aspect of national security. Now, I remember back in the day reading, and this is in elementary and middle school, reading about why, as our textbooks taught us at that time, why America was the greatest nation in the world. Even with the most heinous of crimes, the Nazis, as they said at that time, the Nazis, even though they were the most heinous of people, they had supposedly killed 11 million individuals. We brought them to a court, we gave them a trial, and they were executed fairly. We gave them due process, habeas corpus. But in this day and age, with flying robot killing machines and aversion to the rule of law, we no longer have what once existed as justice. We have what is now flying, killing robot machines flying in the air and zinging out anyone the president does not like or agree with. Now, what is Anwar al-Awlaki's crimes? They say that he was inspiring leagues of Arabs and Muslims to take arms against the United States. So he would go on the YouTubes, go on the internet, and talk about the crimes of the United States government. Talk about how bad they were and why people needed to oppose them. I gotta say, that sounds a little bit like me. That sounds a little bit like a lot of people in the alternative media. That sounds like a lot of people who actually, in the very end, are making sense. Those who are patriotic are those who are willing to dissent. Those who are willing to not accept the doctrines pushed down their throats by those in power. Like our friend Congressman Ron Paul. Now let's listen to what he said about the assassination just hours after it had happened.
Let's hope not. No, I don't think that's a good way to deal with our problems. He's born here. Alaka was born here. He's an American citizen. He was never tried or charged for any crimes. Nobody knows if he ever killed anybody. We know that he might have been associated with the underwear bomber. But if the American people accept this blindly and casually, that we now have an accepted practice of the president assassinating people who he thinks are bad guys, I think it's sad. I think what would the people have said about Timothy McVeigh? We didn't assassinate him. They were pretty certain that he had done it. They went and put him through the courts, and they executed him. But to start assassinating American citizens without charges, we should think very seriously about this.
And as could be predicted, he's received every sort of attack from every neoconservative that lives out there in the media world. One individual that I certainly cannot stand, and more I question his intellect, is this Eric Bolling fellow on Fox Business. He's also on the Fox News at 5 or 6 o'clock, took over Glenn Beck's spot. But this guy, his entire worldview is so skewed and so upside down that he's just representative of a larger portion of the population, but they just do not live in a reality that resembles the truth. They live in a reality where, for some reason, they believe that 99% of the world is out to shoot guns at Americans because they're free and they can watch television and all of these things. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with these programs of assassination, these programs of occupation, and supporting dictatorships across the world. And that's like a fundamental flaw that they do not understand. And because they refuse to believe it, refuse to look up the facts, refuse to actually listen to the people who wish to destroy the nation, well, they're the ones that shall lead us to destruction, not you or I or Congressman Ron Paul. Now, in summary of Anwar al-Awlaki, this is someone who we received the reports before. He's dined at the Pentagon. This was months after 9/11. He was invited to speak on Islam issues. He also did an interview on NPR's Talk of the Nation on November 15th, 2001. You can find the link in the show notes, libertyinexile.com. But he gives a speech. He's the leader of the Dar al-Hare Mosque in Falls Church, Virginia, and he speaks to Neil Conan. Now, I listen to Neil Conan quite often, whether it be driving or anywhere else, and he gives a little explanation of why Muslims might be mad or feel bad after 9/11, and how, you know, it's not all Muslims that are criminals, and that certainly he believes they have a grievance against the United States government and its military arm. It's incredibly interesting if you listen to it. Just go and click in the show notes, you can listen to that. It's quite amazing to think that someone who is on NPR would one day end up being assassinated by a flying robot killing machine. And I'm going to continue using that because A drone basically implies that it's just a movable, dumb force moving and just directs and goes wherever, follows. It's a flying robot killing machine, let us be honest with ourselves. Now, there are a couple of other articles that I've put in the show notes. You can read libertyinexile.com. It's a very interesting issue. I'm glad that some people are starting to be critical. I saw a thing about Herman Cain perhaps questioning it. And the more and more people that actually understand the rule of law and understand what this could mean to them and also what precedent it could set in the future, I believe more people will come on our side. So let us transition from that to talking about, oh, one of my favorite pieces, Soaking the Rich. Now, this has to do with Occupy Wall Street. It has to do with general tax fervor amongst the progressives here in the United States of America, because that is what it is all about now. It's soaking the rich. This is the plot exactly out of Atlas Shrugged. You have millions of people who are clamoring, the government saying we need to tax the rich, we need to take all these people who've stolen all the money and tax them to oblivion. There's a recent article that I also read in NPR that has to do with the state of Oregon, where last year they raised taxes, the citizens voted to raise the income tax, and they saw their top earners all leave the state, and they raised, when they expected to raise over $200 million, they raised less than $100 million and lost a lot of businesses and a lot of jobs. That's an interesting case study, and I believe that Barack Obama's plan for going back and forth, for me, it's not that big of an issue, but it's the rhetoric that counts. It's what you get people to believe, which is exactly what Obama has been doing. He gets people to believe that he's going to do a lot of things, but he doesn't. It was the healthcare debacle. It was, we're going to take all of our troops out of Iraq. All of these things that continually, again and again, he gets proven wrong, and we see that it is nothing but a farce. But on that subject of soaking the rich, this has been a long time coming. I believe it started mostly, probably right after the crisis when you had these huge banker bailouts. Now, of course, I'm 100% against the bailouts. I believe that's one of the most unethical and unfair things the government has done in recent age. And right after that, you had Obama blaming them for giving out these huge bonuses. Well, isn't this the greatest two-faced of concerns? Now, first with the banker bailout first passed by Bush, and then with Obama's stimulus measures and his countless aims to bail out the car industries, he's the one going out and criticizing the bankers for basically paying themselves off. They did a great job. They pay themselves off. That's the way it works. But it was sown at that time. It has sort of been brought up in the tax negotiations in Congress, and then recently, more recently, it has to do with Warren Buffett, the richest man in America, saying, coming out, please raise my taxes. I believe that's sort of the thing that sparked it, that sparked most people's reactions, and you had the richer people come out and say, I believe we do need more taxes. You had Ted Turner on Bloomberg Television saying that. He was afraid that he'd have to sell some of his paintings and might have to sell some of his ranches and that, you know, in order for the government to work efficiently, people got to pay their fair share. But, as he said, he himself doesn't want to be taxed to oblivion. But I think when the interesting thing that I like to do when we're talking about soaking the rich, which is actually a moniker, a phrase that was used back in the age of the Great Depression. And this ties into my greater theory, and I've stated it on this program before, that we are living in the cycle of the Great Depression. It's coming back once more. Everything we see, protectionism, government programs, stimulus measures, the more and more that this continues, the more and more that we're just living through history, ladies and gentlemen. We're living through history. It's the same thing over and over again. And we can look to the same people to make the same mistakes, and Obama is playing his role as FDR and continually proposing these large government programs which pay one person to dig a hole and then to fill it back up with borrowed money. And that's the way it works. But let us go back in the archive vault to listen to the rhetoric of that time and see how it compares to today. This is one Senator Huey Long, who became governor of Louisiana, was an amazing figure in American politics, and what he thinks about the rich. Play the clip.
According to the tables which we have assembled, it is our estimate that 4% of the American people own 85% of the wealth of America. And that over 70% of the people of America don't own enough to pay the debts that they owe. How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what's intended for 9/10 of the people to eat? The only way you'll ever be able to feed the balance of the people is to make that man come back and bring back some of that grub he ain't got no business with. We start from the bottom. That the 25 or more million American families shall have a homestead, a home, and the comforts of a home including an automobile and a radio, the things it takes in that house to live on. We say to America, 125 million, none shall be too big, none shall be too poor, none shall work too much, none shall be idle. No luxurious mansions empty, none walking the streets, none impoverished, none in pestilence, none in want, but in the land blessed by the smile of the Creator, with everything to be consumed, to be eaten, to be worn, that America will become a land sharing the fruits of the land, not for the favored few, not to satisfy greed, but that all may live in a land in which the Lord has provided an abundance sufficient for the luxury and convenience of the people in general, I think.
Now, while Mr. Huey Long may be much more eloquent than a lot of the people we hear today, it is the same message played out again and again. Soak the rich. We need to tax and drive the people who produce the most to oblivion. That is the wrong attitude to take. What we need to do, of course, is look at the entire role of the institutions that brought us to this brink, brought us to this moment in time. And it is not just the rich that have brought us here. The rich have brought us here. They've brought us to the level of wealth that we enjoy today. The richest men in America, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Warren Buffett, they've done everything to bring technology, transportation, communication. And we are the ones who are first to blame them? Now, there is blame to be had. There is blame to be had on the American banks. I do not spare them one single penny. They are a lot of the problem today. But the biggest problem is the one who guarantees and protects those who lead the people astray. And in this case, and in every case that we've seen, it is the central bank and the government of the United States of America. It is the central bank, the Federal Reserve. By the printing of that money continuously, again and again, these $600 billion, $2.3 trillion, $1.4 trillion to loan to foreign banks in order to bail out Greece and the countries of the Eurozone. These are the institutions and these are the actions which have led us to the point which we see today, the point where we have been brought to the brink. This is where it is, ladies and gentlemen. It's not about soaking the rich. It's not about that, it's about having to cut what we expect. It's about not assuming that those that we elect to office are more wise, will know how to allocate resources any more than you or I. Because that is all that it goes down to. How much should you keep of what you earn yourself? Imagine it as an individual, because that is how it should play out. And in keeping with history, let us go back and listen to a dissenting voice from that period, a man who was not along with FDR, who was not agreeing with Huey Long, who was not cheering on the government intervention and bailouts and programs which continually stagnated the American economy and kept that Great Depression going on for longer than it should have. Let us listen to Senator from Ohio of the time, Robert Taft.
Businessmen of today distrust this government policy, because they realize that in the end it is absolutely destructive of the entire business system of individual enterprise and of adequate rewards for thrift, industry, and ability, the system which has made America what it is. They can't work together with a government which talks of business appeasement but is still animated by a strong leaning to planned economy. Businessmen consider it impossible to work with a government which still believes that a people can spend itself into prosperity and adds $10 million every day to the public debt, which businessmen will have to pay off sooner or later. They certainly wouldn't work with another businessman headed for the bankruptcy court, and they hesitate to work with a government headed in the same direction.
Oh, the historical perspective of our times. We're living through that Greater Depression number 2. Now back on this. Once we come back, this is Liberty in Exile on the Liberty Radio Network and on the No Agenda Stream. We'll be right back after this.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with the drum. Say, don't you remember, they called me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime?
That was Bing Crosby with Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? That's a hit from the Great Depression. And we're playing it out once again here on Liberty in Exile on the Liberty Radio Network, as well as the No Agenda Stream. We welcome you back. Let us get back into soaking the rich. That's what it's all about. We're going to go back and look at the different articles that have to do with this certain subject. Now, before we played a clip for Mr. Huey Long, a senator in the United States during the Great Depression and also governor of Louisiana. I believe there have been a few movies done about him. He was quite an eccentric character, but his personification goes to explain what goes on as well with the others. Now, there's some articles that I've linked to on libertyinexile.com that you can check out. One is from the Globe and Mail, talking about how this is the stagflation of the 1970s lived again. So whether it is the Great Depression of the 1930s or the stagflation of the 1970s, it is not an economic time for us to celebrate. We'll just say that. It is not the time for our finest China, but our finest Dixie cups. Another articles that I like to get to, I talked before about the NPR article talking about Oregon and how they raised their taxes and basically all the productive, innovative people left directly. And I guess the number one man in the crossfires has been President Barack Obama. Now, I don't put direct blame on him. It's more of the system, this perpetual bailout system where you have a dollar bill that's based on absolutely nothing, and you have a government that is ready and willing to bail out any and all industry which shows its card or donates to its campaign. That is the problem, that is what is essential, and that is what is driving a lot of young people into the streets. We've seen it for the first time here in America. Now, I've been talking about this as something that people might need to do for over 3 years. Since I was first on the airwaves in Montreal on CJLO, I have hit this drum, and it's talking about a populist uprising, the people finally getting back the reins of their democracy. Now, there are a lot of people who are in charge of this Occupy Wall Street, who are in the street, who I may not agree with, but the whole point is not that everyone agrees on a certain attainable goal. It's more about correcting what is going on now. It's more about criticizing the point that we are at. And in doing so, let us get a small little resume from our friends over there at the BBC.
Angry at their treatment by the banks and by the police. The protesters of the Occupy Wall Street movement have spent 2 weeks camped outside the New York Stock Exchange, making their frustration clear at foreclosures, high unemployment and multi-billion dollar bank bailouts. The demonstrators liken their protest to similar social movements in European cities, such as the Spanish capital, Madrid.
People are realizing that we are all one, and it is our governments that work against us to keep everyone down, and that's how the 1% gets away with it, is by dividing us up and people not realizing we are all one. And that's what this movement's about, all over the world.
Now the group has marched on New York's police headquarters after an officer allegedly used pepper spray on a small group who were already being held inside a police cordon. A video of the incident has received hundreds of thousands of views on YouTube.
We're here, right here now, protesting a police officer who brutalized one of the people in the movement, pepper spraying them when they were just standing there. So we're out here to let them know that that's not something that we'll tolerate, and we want to make sure there's some accountability for that kind of violence that was perpetrated against the nonviolent movement.
Inquiries into the incident have been opened, the New York police commissioner announced, as smaller demonstrations were held in other cities, including Boston, Chicago, and San Francisco. Meanwhile, the organizers are talking about staying on Wall Street for the long haul and are already making plans to occupy downtown Manhattan during New York's bitter winter. Will Grant, BBC News.
Now, you see, some of these protesters actually understand, and they get it. They understand that the force of government is what allows things like the banks to basically rob our people. It is because of those institutions that are in place that such wealth distribution that is unequal exists. And, you know, as far as I can tell, that's not the grand majority of the people involved in this movement, but this is, as some has termed, the American Spring, right? What's interesting is how the power structure reacts to these sort of things. You have the New York Times, which is the most mainstream of publications. I just had an article the other day on the 27th of September talking about how, as the scorn for vote grows, protests surge across the globe. And it brings up the interesting point that as all these revolutions were going on in the Middle East during the spring, and you had popular uprisings in Libya and Egypt and Tunisia and Syria and the like, you had the power structure, the big media companies, and the government alike cheering them on as the people were clamoring for democracy. But as it happens here, what do we see but the police going out with pepper mace and macing innocent people just protesting their grievances? We sort of see the double standard. In the beginning of these protests, these occupations of certain financial districts across the country, most mainstream media just sort of discounted this. They saw this as just some sort of left-wing socialist movement, the people in the streets. Even NPR was going to the point of justifying not covering this. There was a point where the ombudsman put out a whole report saying, why, well, you know, we shouldn't cover Occupy Wall Street now, and he gave 3 points justifying why National Public Radio should not cover this. Now, as this has grown into thousands and has grown across the country, and the themes are more well-known, well, it seems as if the media is covering it. Even the local media here in Philadelphia, even the national corporate mainstream media, Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, and the like, are forced to cover it as well. And it is very interesting. It is interesting to be living in this time. It is interesting to see where this began, what the inspirations are, and where it will bring us. Now, I've scored through a lot of articles, looked at a lot of interviews, read a lot of different things, and there are a lot of people in the crowd who are holding up End the Fed books, who are talking about
fractional reserve banking, while others are just talking about how they have a lot of debt, which I really don't understand. Taking on debt is a voluntary thing, so I don't understand how, you know, that has absolutely nothing to do with it. But again, the people diverge. And that is what's so great, is you have so many different people who are inspired by so many different things to go out into the street. And one man who came down to visit the rallies, you've had a few quote-unquote celebrities who've tried to make their way down and try to push a book in Michael Moore's case, or just try to get some shots with the press in Susan Sarandon's case. You have people who are quite genuine. And one man who I believe is pretty genuine is Cornel West. Dr. Cornel West is a professor at Harvard, and he's been very vocal in his attacks on Obama and progressives who are in power now, and that they are not staying true to the message, and that they are catering to the banks, and that this is continually ongoing, and that they should not give their support to President Barack Obama in the 2012 election. Let's listen to a little bit of Cornel West about what this means to him and what is at the core of the new progressive movement as far as he's concerned. Listen here.
You see what I mean? That well-to-do groups whine when they have wealth privilege but want more from the president. Can you imagine Brother Barack Obama going to the business roundtable and saying, stop grumbling, stop complaining, stop crying? Never. What did he say to them? He said, I'm going to deliver for you. He said, I'm sorry. I should have brought you a cake. We have got 42% of our black children living in poverty. 22% we talked about before, people living in poverty. They have a right to cry. They have a right to have legitimate grievances. So I think the president ought to apologize. I think he ought to ask for our forgiveness.
Really?
Yes, we've been subdued. The only persons who have been out there critical, Tavis Smiley, myself, and a few others, we get demonized. And keep in mind, when he says African-American leaders, I want to make this very clear. I'm not a black leader. I'm a lover of black people.
Indeed.
I'm not a leader of black people. I'm a leader of anybody concerned about poor people and working people.
Many people would confer that status on you because of your status.
No, but the thing is, it's poor and working people. But the important thing is the love. The problem is we got black leaders who do not love black people. And we got black people who love black people who are not leaders. But I'm in the legacy of Martin King. You got to love them first and whatever they call you.
You've been very critical of the president. But in all seriousness, sir,
yes.
Final question.
Yes.
Do you really want a leader like the serial adulterer, Newt Gingrich, like the self-confessed academic failure of Rick Perry,
yes,
or the peddler of myths and half-truths, Michelle Bachmann? Would you prefer that?
That's the mendacity and the mean-spiritedness we must oppose, but I refuse to accept the notion that because these folks are so mediocre and mean-spirited, that we can't be critical of Barack Obama. That's why Ralph Nader and I are saying what? We're going to have a robust discussion. We want a dialogue with Barack Obama. We want to make him stronger and at the same time bring critique to bear, because we want the same influence for poor people that lobbyists have for wealthy people when it comes to Barack Obama. And why? Because in the end, both parties, Brother Martin, are tied to oligarchic and plutocratic rule. This is a problem in our society. Both parties, in that sense, too tied to big money. You see where he is now? Raising big money to the well-to-do, Goldman Sachs and others, and then telling black people, oh my God, stop crying, stop crying. I'm concerned about you. Goldman Sachs concerned about black people, poor people, working people.
Please. That's Dr. Cornel West on MSNBC, Martin Bashir, just talking about the whole progressive movement and in the age of trying to pit against Obama. And sort of, you see how it plays into the Occupy Wall Street narrative, and he said a lot of things in there. He says that he's not a leader of black people, but I'm a lover of black people. You know, I hope I fall into the same camp. But as we look on to other subjects here, and this Occupy Wall Street thing is a very big deal, and it will continue to go on. And the more that the media tries to define it, the more it's going to turn into something that will organize over time. We saw that with the Tea Party, and it was the same way, but the media went to the lengths of demonizing them to the point of, well, anytime you mention the Tea Party now, it sort of sends a lot of people into downfall. It's quite interesting that any populist movements always seek some sort of retribution for grievances, for wrongs, and the more and more that they pop up, the more that the power structure, the media, those in government try to put them down, try to demean them, try to make the case that they should not exist or try to criticize them or bemoan them. I mean, this goes on again and again, and it is the people at the very top, those very elites, who continuously put this down. And this is on both sides. They did the same thing to the Tea Party, and they'll do the same thing with this Occupy Wall Street. Anyway, there are plenty of links you can check out on libertyinexile.com. You can see that. There's plenty that's very interesting. And there's something, we've been talking about the bad financial news, talking about assassinations of American citizens. It's time we turn to a much happier and sort of more reasoned subject. Now, one thing that I watched recently was the new Ken Burns documentary on prohibition in the United States. Now, this man has the most soothing voice in the world, and he provides the best clarity to the most complicated of subjects. If you haven't seen it yet, I recommend the Civil War documentary that he put out back in 1990. Incredible. But he did one that recently on prohibition, the time in the United States of America when people were not allowed, were barred by the Constitution from purchasing or consuming alcohol. How interesting was that? I'm going to play a little clip of an interview that Ken Burns did with Reason TV talking about this, how it ties into the drug war, and freedom and liberties today.
But I think in every case, Dan's book, Boardwalk Empire, and our film, it's the understanding that prohibition reveals a lot more. This is the story of single-issue political campaigns that metastasize with the most horrible unintended consequences, including creating organized crime, which we wouldn't have. This is about the demonization of recent immigrants. This is about a whole group of people who feel like they've lost control of their country and want to re-exert that control by imposing on these newcomers some new law. It sounds so familiar with today. It resonates with today's themes.
What are the parallels with today? I mean, is the parallel directly to the drug war?
No, I think it's less to that. I mean, alcohol is used by every culture since there have been human beings. Drugs are a subcultural thing. Alcohol was something everybody did, so eliminating it required a great act of faith to take place. Drugs are not favored by a majority of people, and so while there are lots of similarities, and the possibility of taxing and regulating marijuana is a hugely interesting consideration, once again, it's unintended consequences. You have to be careful. I just think it's so much like our political moment. Lack of civil discourse, the demonization of immigrants, smear campaigns during presidential elections, all of this sort of single-issue campaigning, all of that stuff resonates with today because, in fact, human nature is the same. And prohibition brings out and reveals to us our essential dichotomy, not between us as much as within us, the generosity and the greed, the Puritanness and the purience, the sincerity and the hypocrisy, the Saturday night at the bar and the Sunday morning in church. And so that's always been America's torn on that tension.
Now, Ken Burns sort of downplays the link to the drug war today and the prohibition on marijuana, but in researching this story and trying to understand, I mean, in the news recently, there's been a big talk about prohibition, Boardwalk Empire winning some Emmys. You have a book that just came out. You have Kevin Burns' documentary. It's in the news, and it's something that people are again, as history plays through, and again, history is very important. It reminds us of that narrative that has existed before us, that every issue that we're talking about today, that we're arguing about, has already been talked about at lengths sometime in the past. The arguments about empire and republic happened in Rome. The arguments about soaking the rich happened in the Great Depression, and the arguments about legalizing, taxing drugs happened during the age of prohibition. And in researching this story, I came across a very interesting article. This is from a blog, The Colorado Restless Native, having to do with medicinal whiskey. Now, much as the medicinal marijuana of today, there's a piece that was recently on local Philadelphia news about some marijuana dispensaries that are coming up, and medical marijuana little shops that are springing up in New Jersey and how a lot of people are very against it. And, of course, the mainstream media here, which, unfortunately, I'm a part of, comes out and says, well, you know, the older people aren't for this, and, you know, it scares. It'll bring a lot of thuggery and crime in the area. Oh. I mean, when you have the Mexican border, when you have 10,000 people just killed this year in 2011, I mean, that's a fact right there on the table. 10,000 individuals, human beings, you and I, maybe with darker skin, were killed in Mexico last year because of the drug war that we continue to have here in the United States of America. 40,000 individuals have been killed in the last 5 years. 40,000. And it continues. And the little old ladies who don't want a medical marijuana dispensary say that it should continue to be illegal. Well, Granny, it can be illegal, sure, but you're going to be the one who's going to have to wash your hands of blood. So going back to this article about medicinal whiskey, here's a reading from the article. During Prohibition in the 20s and early 30s, it was often referred to as the loophole. Section 6 and 7 of the Volstead Act provided a way to legally purchase and sell whiskey at a time when it was otherwise a criminal activity. No one shall manufacture, sell, or prescribe any liquor without first obtaining a permit from the commissioner to do so, except that a person may, without a permit, purchase and use liquor for medicinal purposes. There was more legalese, stipulations, and etceteras, of course, but the lawyers saw light in Section 6 and Section 7, which gave some power to the doctor. No one but a physician holding a permit to prescribe liquor shall issue any prescription for liquor, and no physician shall prescribe liquor unless after careful physical examination of the person, for whose such prescription is sought or such examination is found impracticable, then upon the best information obtainable, he in good faith believes that the use of such liquor as medicine by such person is necessary and will afford relief to him from some known ailment. So what did this mean back in the day? It meant that doctors would open up shop, men would line up in the streets, and they would get a special card allowing them to buy medicinal whiskey. Now, how does this compare today? Very easy. Just look at California, where there are more marijuana shops than Starbucks, where it's easier to get stoked, get stoned, get high than it is to get a caramel frappuccino. It is a turning tide. As soon as this generation changes, as soon as there's some sort of slip-up, some sort of a change, one generation dies off and another comes into an existence, there will be a shift in this policy, and it will be in our lifetimes that marijuana is legal. And other drugs, hopefully so as well. But in keeping with drugs and drug testing and the virtual nature of drugs in our society, there's a specific bill that was passed recently having to do with drug test welfare, right? That's the way it works. So basically, in order to get welfare benefits, people in the state of Florida have to take a drug test, whereas if they somehow have any drugs in their bodies, they're not allowed to get benefits. And this is something that even upset a former drug czar. Now, I forget this guy's name, Barry something. I normally don't like the guy. I find him laughable. But he makes a lot of sense in this clip. Let's play this.
But first, a new survey shows 7 out of 10 Floridians support drug testing welfare recipients.
As Mike Fasolinda tells us, former White House drug policy coordinator Barry McCaffrey says the testing is counterproductive.
Studies show more than one of every four returning veterans is either alcohol or drug addicted. The number is growing every day.
We're getting a lot of these kids home who are seriously damaged.
Former White House drug czar Barry McCaffrey, speaking to a crowd of former and recovering addicts near Pensacola, says the problem is worse. Many soldiers are returning to fight impaired.
And we owe them significant interventions in their life.
Asked about Florida's new policy of testing welfare recipients, some of whom are returning veterans, McCaffrey says the policy is misguided.
What kind of sense does that make? You got to make the barriers to entry into rehabilitation low. You want people in treatment.
A former Navy veteran is the lead plaintiff in the ACLU's lawsuit against testing.
Clinical experts generally support drug testing, but they say once someone tests positive, there needs to be treatment.
something the state doesn't offer to those who test positive.
Children are not responsible for their parent using. We need to offer some kind of help.
Treatment experts say post-traumatic stress is the first indication of possible addiction, and as more veterans return, can't find work, and apply for benefits, more of them will be denied.
So, very interesting report. Barry, whatever his name is, the guy with the lazy eye, he is one of the fiercest drug warriors that exist in our society. He was the drug czar for George Bush, and he continues to be whenever this issue comes up, the number one advocate for continuing the laws and continuing to federalize our police agencies and send in SWAT teams for people who might have a joint or two in their house. But he makes a good point. But in going against him once more, we have to talk about this drug war, and not just about the drugs themselves, but what they mean for individual liberty, for what they mean for your freedoms, for what they mean for the Fourth Amendment. Now, the Fourth Amendment has, in recent times, been shredded to bits, much like most of the Constitution. But there are some fierce warriors out there who continue to protect it, who continue to speak out, and continue to help the rest of us understand its importance, significance, and how much, if it is to be protected, it shall continue to be a virtue in our society. So let us play a clip from one of our warriors, that is Andrew Napolitano, from Freedom Watch, on the Fourth Amendment, your liberties, and what it means to a new dawning of an American republic.
The Bill of Rights guaranteed that the government could not on its own assault your natural rights. Among them, that quintessentially American right, the right to be left alone. Today we call this right the right to privacy. The Fourth Amendment requires that the government, before the government can assault your right to privacy and search your possessions, come onto your property, listen to your phone calls, read your mail, monitor your keystrokes on your computer, or even obtain records about you from other sources like doctors, banks, or lawyers. It must present evidence of criminal behavior on your part, under oath, to a judge. And only if the judge accepts that evidence, and only if the judge issues a search warrant, may the government legally seek and seize whatever is specifically described in the warrant. No more government knocking on doors in the middle of the night and taking whatever it wished. Regrettably, the federal government has labored mightily to get around all this. Even though every person who works for the government has taken an oath to uphold the Constitution, many of them seem to spend more time avoiding and evading it. In the days after 9/11, Congress enacted the Patriot Act, an abominable piece of legislation which permits federal agents to write their own search warrants. With the Patriot Act, we have come full circle from the days in which a king unleashed soldiers upon us on their own to the present day in which our elected representatives have unleashed federal agents upon us on their own, all in utter disregard for our natural right to be left alone and the constitutional requirements of a judicially issued search warrant. The Patriot Act, perpetrated by a Republican president and Congress, was and is one of the gravest legislative assaults on human freedom. It was harshly criticized at the time by a young Democratic senator from Illinois named Barack Obama. But freedom must look very different from inside the White House than from outside. This morning we learned from the front page of the Wall Street Journal that the Obama Justice Department, without obtaining search warrants, has been using a computer program called Stingray, which manipulates your cell phone to enable the government to follow you whenever the phone is with you. And last month, the Obama Justice Department told the Supreme Court that it has been installing GPS systems on the cars of those without cell phones so it can follow them. And last spring, the Obama Justice Department persuaded the court to let cops break down doors without a search warrant on the basis of what they think they smell from coming behind the doors. And somehow it claims that the Fourth Amendment is no obstacle to all this. What's going on here? Is this really America in 2011, or is it East Germany in 1961? Would the government prefer to watch all of us, to seize our computer records, to listen to our conversations, to break down our doors whenever it wished, without following the Constitution? Yes, it would. Power by nature expands. That's why we have a constitution, to restrain governmental power. Who would want to live in a society where the government was unrestrained? Have we fought wars against totalitarian governments only to find that we have elected one here at home? Did you even know that the federal government may be using your cell phone to follow you wherever you go? Have we become a nation of sheep? Sadly, the answers to these questions are obvious.
Now, were wise, wise words from our Andrew Napolitano on Fox Business, one of the only sane voices on that network, as you heard earlier. And in commending Judge Napolitano and in hearing the voices that at times it seems as if it's a voice in the wilderness, that voice of reason that amongst all the insanity somehow continues to plug out and we hear it on the airwaves. It's very important. I believe the internet has done a great thing for that. Now I want to talk a little bit about Facebook and its political action committee and the meshing with the government here in just a later section, but in talking about voices in the wilderness, I believe that's a very important point. Because we have to understand that revolutions and changes in doctrine and in thinking were not because the mass of society all of a sudden decided it wasn't right anymore to follow the status quo. It's always been because of leaders who, at the time, were made fun of, were shouted down, were told they were crazy, they were kooky, but then in the end they turned out to be right. And we're living that in the age of the Ron Paul Revolution, and we're also living as the United States of Europe crumbles before our eyes. Now, a lot of listeners to this program, as far as the messages that I've gotten, emails and messages and the like, are very interested that I continue to talk about the United States of Europe. Now, having lived there, having seen the examples, having studied it, I believe it's one of the most interesting experiments in our time, but it is, unfortunately, doomed to fail. That is not to say that Europe should fail. Just this political union, this supranational government that has been installed there, that should fail. And in listening to most of the politicians, most of the leaders, people don't really understand what goes on in the European Union, and that is why we looked to our one teacher, our one savior, who is standing strong and firm in the European Union, and he was out there telling us the truth, that is, leader of the United Kingdom Independence Party, our leader, Nigel Farage.
During your speech, Mr. Barroso, there was an all-pervading sense of gloom. And I saw for the first time even your own supporters shaking their heads. They don't believe in what you're saying. The European people don't believe in what you're saying. And I don't really think even you now believe in what you're saying. Because we all know that Greece is going to default. The end game for Greece is near. And you can't say you weren't warned. You were told that the treaties were fatally flawed. You were all told that Greece should never have joined the euro. And when I stood up here 5 years ago and talked about Greek bond spreads, you treated me with such utter derision, it was as if I'd been let out of the local lunatic asylum. No, you've been warned all the way through. So now what you've got is economic governance. And everybody here in this front row supports more European economic governance. What is European economic governance? I'll tell you what it is. It's a plane landing at Athens Airport, out of which get an official from the Commission, an official from the European Central Bank, and an official for the appalling IMF. And those three people, the Troika you call them, go in, they meet the Greek government, and they tell the Greek government what they may or may not do. You have killed democracy in Greece. You have three part-time overseas dictators that now tell the Greek people what they can and can't do. It is totally unacceptable. Is it any wonder that Greek people are now burning EU flags and drawing swastikas across them? You are, frankly, unless Greece is allowed to get out of this economic and political prison, you may well spark a revolution in that country. I suppose there is some good news, at least. And that is that in Germany, people are waking up. Right up to the president, people are saying, all of this represents the death of democracy. None of this can work. And the German people simply will refuse in the end to pay the bill. Your one achievement is you have split Europe between north and south. The Greeks now badmouth the Germans. The Germans badmouth the Greeks. I have one last plea, Mr. Barroso. Will you please help Greece? Help her to get her currency back, help her to reschedule her debts, help her out of the mess that you have put her into. Your policies have failed. Stand up. Be a man. Admit it.
There is no more statement that brings a smile to my face than anything made by Nigel Farage. He is a courageous man in the European Union, standing up to defend the principles of self-determination, democracy, individual liberty, and freedom. Can anyone believe that there is one man standing apart from the others in the United States of Europe? We commend you once more, Nigel Farage. And there are other people who are quite instrumental in that. Daniel Hannan, he comes to mind. He has a few videos that I've linked to on libertyinexile.com in the show notes. You can check that out. And we're talking about a complete anti-democratic system of governance there. A European governance where it is no longer individual nations or parliaments which shall decide taxes to be levied or what money shall be spent where. It is a continual anti-democratic supranational institution. That is what we're living through. That is what is continuing to go on, and there's very interesting articles that came out just this week. It seems as if Germany has said they will not give out any more to the European bailout funds. You had Russia's Vladimir Putin coming out and saying he wants to build a Eurasian Union. He's seen how much the vote is being taken away from the individual peoples of Europe and how the oligarchs can come into power in the United States of Europe, and he's quite interested and inspired and liked to do the same in bringing together Asia and Europe. Well, now we know that we're headed in the wrong direction. Solidarity, my European brothers and sisters. I believe in you. Believe in your true leaders. Believe in the self-righteousness and the virtue of your own constitutions and your own rights as nations. And that is what shall pull you through. Now, in speaking about individuals, in speaking about organizations which work above nations, there's one which comes to mind here in the United States that sort of acts on its own. One that is meshed in all of our lives personally. That is that of Facebook. One of the most important internet mediums. This is the website that is visited by more people, it is said, than any other website. It has over 500 million users, probably around 300 million active users, and it is a significant force. No one can deny that. In the revolutions of the Arab Spring, everyone talked about Facebook all the time. In the revolutions that were going on in England, people would post stuff on their status, and they would be imprisoned because they quote-unquote tried to inspire mass revolution. This is an important tool for the people, and it is not, however, the ultimate end. Facebook is a means, and is a means for many different groups of people. For people like me, it's to connect to, say, beautiful women in Austria, or to connect to family who's living in other parts of the country or all over the world. Or Facebook is also used for getting to know certain sectors, but the grassroots of Facebook, the undermining belly of Facebook, well, it is nothing but a marketing scheme. There's an article in Bloomberg where Mark Zuckerberg talks about how it is just one big marketing scheme. That is all Facebook is. It exists in order to give your information over to the authorities, or to sell your information to private marketing companies. This is no secret, it's put out there, it's said, and people are not listening most of the time, so they don't understand. But an article in Reuters just points this out once more. This article just came out the other day. Internet firms co-opted for surveillance experts. Internet companies such as Google, Twitter, and Facebook are increasingly co-opted for surveillance work, as the information they gather proves irresistible to law enforcement agencies, web experts said this week. Although such companies try to keep their users' information private, their business models depend on exploiting it to sell targeted advertising, and when governments demand they hand it over, they have little choice but to comply. Suggestions that BlackBerry maker RIM might give user data to British police after its messenger service was used to coordinate riots this summer caused outrage, as has the spying on social media users by more oppressive governments. But the vast amount of personal information that companies like Google, and Facebook collect to run their businesses have become simply too valuable for police and governments to ignore. And that is the continuing presence of these companies. And they're interestingly enough, you have one of these companies who is meshing with Washington more than all the others, more than Google, more than Yahoo, more than Microsoft, and that is Facebook. Let's listen to this small report here. This will be our last thing for the show, talking about Facebook's new political action committee, full of people who worked in the White House before and have worked in government, and we see this huge collusion that is a Big Brother state revisited in Facebook form. I like this.
Other issues that might invite lobbying by internet firms: intellectual property, patents, taxes, and the biggie for Facebook, privacy.
They are playing a unique role as a company in terms of all of the privacy and personal data that they control. And there's no question that they are going to be dealing more and more with legal overtures and regulatory challenges that are going to require extensive governmental interaction.
Disclosure forms show that Facebook, which had almost no presence in Washington a couple of years ago, has been ramping up on the political front, hiring big guns like Erskine Bowles, President Clinton's former chief of staff, and former Clinton press secretary Joe Lockhart.
With Google, with all of these tech companies, we're seeing a real spike in activity in their campaign donations and lobbying.
Facebook so far has spent more than $550,000 on lobbying this year, almost as much as it's spent in the past 2 years combined. Google has spent about six times as much, or $3.5 million, on lobbying this year.
Now, last year, Facebook had two lobbyists in Washington. This year, it has more than two dozen lobbyists. Well,
you can only imagine how many it will have next year if that growth continues. They tried to hire the former White House press secretary, Robert Gibbs, but that didn't work out.
Yeah, you know, they are really going for the big names here. That's the point, is that it's not just two dozen, you know, random lobbyists. These are people who are very well connected. A number of people who've been through the revolving door, who used to work in government, now working for the private sector. You know, we see it, we saw with Joe Lockhart, Erskine Bowles, and so forth, and other names on that list too. So expect Facebook to be a significant presence here in Washington.
Yeah, and I assume they'll hire some bunch of Republicans as well. A good lobbying group in Washington needs Republicans and Democrats, especially at a time of divided government like this. Thanks very much. Good report, Lisa.
She got that special good report, Lisa, from Woof. And it is very interesting. This is the new age. These internet companies are the railroads of yesterday, are the Standard Oil and Carnegie Steel of the days that we used to know. These are the industries that are most dominant in our society, but we also have to understand that they are quite important. They're important because these are the ventures that will lead us out of this Great Depression. They are the innovators and the industrialists and the people of today who shall try to attempt to bring prosperity. And it's not through collective government effort. It's not through organized, collective, manipulated markets as done by government forces and bureaucracies and agencies. It's done by the free market. It's done by innovators, smart people working for their self-interest and trying to build a product that they know their customers would enjoy. If only that sentiment could be spread elsewhere. It is not the time to demonize the rich, to soak them, as some have claimed, but it is rather the time to look in ourselves, to become innovative, to seek to detach ourselves from the system that we've become dependent upon. We have the capacity. We are smarter than that. We are much more intelligent, and we all have it within us to have that success. It is something attainable, not just for you or for me, but for the grand masses. And that is what something like Occupy Wall Street is demonstrating to thousands, hundreds of thousands, and hopefully one day, millions. Now, I've done my part. I've gone through the mainstream media, ripped it apart, done the media assassination that is important. Now it is your turn. Go out there, use this knowledge to make the right decisions and to change the day and age which we live in. Make it not a depression, but make it a great age of innovation and progress. You are the only ones who shall change the status quo that we live in, that we are locked in step in. Until next time, brothers and sisters, I leave you with that. Broadcasting on the Liberty Radio Network as well as the No Agenda Stream, I'm your host, Yael Osonsky, reporting from the Philly Freedom Studio. It's been an amazing time. Au revoir et bonne chance à tous.
LibertyInExile.com